Chapter 5. The Roots of Morality. Why Are We Good?
Strange is our situation here on Earth. Each of us comes for a short visit, not knowing why, yet sometimes seeming to divine a purpose. From the standpoint of daily life, however, there is one thing we do know, that man is here for the sake of other men, above all for those upon whose smiles and well-being our own happiness depends. Albert Einstein.
Many religious people find it hard to imagine how, without religion, one can be good, or would even want to be good. I shall discuss such questions in this chapter, but the doubts go further and drive some religious people to paroxysms of hatred against those who don't share their faith. This is important because moral considerations lie hidden behind religious attitudes to other topics that have no real link with morality. A great deal of the opposition to the teaching of evolution has no connection with evolution itself or with anything scientific, but is spurred on by moral outrage. If you teach children that they evolved from monkeys, then they will act like monkeys. I receive a large number of letters from readers of my books, most of them enthusiastically friendly, some of them helpfully critical, a few nasty or even vicious. And the nastiest of all, I'm sorry to report, are almost invariably motivated by religion. Such unchristian abuse is commonly experienced by those who are perceived as enemies of Christianity. Here, for example, is a letter posted on the internet and addressed to Brian Fleming, author and director of The God Who Wasn't There, a sincere and moving film advocating atheism. Titled Burn While We Laugh and dated 21st of December 2005, the letter to Fleming reads as follows.
You've definitely got some nerve. I'd love to take a knife, gut you fools, and scream with joy as your insides spill out in front of you. You are attempting to ignite a holy war in which someday I and others like me may have the pleasure of taking action like the above mentioned.
The writer at this point seems to come to a belated recognition that his language is not very Christian, for he goes on more charitably.
However, God teaches us not to seek vengeance, but to pray for those like you all.
His charity is short-lived, however.
I'll get comfort in knowing that the punishment God will bring to you will be 1,000 times worse than anything I can inflict. The best part is that you will suffer for eternity for those sins that you're completely ignorant about. The wrath of God will show no mercy. For your sake, I hope the truth is revealed to you before the knife connects with your flesh. Merry Christmas! P.S. You people really don't have a clue as to what is in store for you. I thank God I'm not you.
I find it genuinely puzzling that a mere difference of theological opinion can generate such venom. Here's a sample from the postbag of the editor of the magazine Free Thought Today, published by the Freedom from Religion Foundation, FFRF, which campaigns peacefully against the undermining of the constitutional separation of church and state.
Hello, cheese-eating scumbags. There are way more of us Christians than you losers. There is no separation of church and state, and you heathens will lose.
What is it with cheese? American friends have suggested to me a connection with the notoriously liberal state of Wisconsin, home of the FFRF, and centre of the dairy industry. But surely there must be more to it than that. And how about those French cheese-eating surrender monkeys? What is the semiotic iconography of cheese? To continue.
Satan-worshipping scum, please die and go to hell. I hope you get a painful disease like rectal cancer and die a slow, painful death so you can meet your god, Satan. Hey, dude, this freedom from religion thing sucks. So, you fags and dykes, take it easy and watch where you go, 'cause whenever you least expect it, God will get you. If you don't like this country and what it was founded on and for, get the fuck out of it and go straight to hell. P.S. Fuck you, you communist whore. Get your black asses out of the USA. You are without excuse. Creation is more than enough evidence of the Lord Jesus Christ's omnipotent power.
Why not Allah's omnipotent power, or Lord Brahma's, or even Yahweh's?
We will not go quietly away. If in the future that requires violence, just remember you brought it on. My rifle is loaded.
Why, I can't help wondering, is God thought to need such ferocious defence? One might have supposed him amply capable of looking after himself. Bear in mind through all this that the editor, being abused and threatened so viciously, is a gentle and charming young woman. Perhaps because I don't live in America, most of my hate mail is not quite in the same league, but nor does it display to advantage the charity for which the founder of Christianity was notable. The following, dated May 2005 from a British medical doctor, while it is certainly hateful, strikes me as more tormented than nasty, and reveals how the whole issue of morality is a deep wellspring of hostility towards atheism. After some preliminary paragraphs excoriating evolution, and sarcastically asking whether a Negro is still in the process of evolving, insulting Darwin personally, misquoting Huxley as an anti-evolutionist, and encouraging me to read a book, I have read it, which argues that the world is only 8,000 years old, can he really be a doctor? He concludes,
"Your own books, your prestige in Oxford, everything you love in life and have ever achieved, are an exercise in total futility." Camus' question challenge becomes inescapable. Why don't we all commit suicide? Indeed, your worldview has that sort of effect on students and many others. That we all evolved by blind chance from nothing and return to nothing. Even if religion were not true, it is better, much, much better, to believe a noble myth like Plato's if it leads to peace of mind while we live. But your worldview leads to anxiety, drug addiction, violence, nihilism, hedonism, Frankenstein science, and hell on earth, and World War III. I wonder how happy you are in your personal relationships. Divorced? Widowed? Gay? Those like you are never happy, or they would not try so hard to prove there is no happiness nor meaning in anything.
The sentiment of this letter, if not its tone, is typical of many. Darwinism, this person believes, is inherently nihilistic, teaching that we evolve by blind chance and are annihilated when we die. For the umpteenth time, natural selection is the very opposite of a chance process. As a direct consequence of such alleged negativity, all manner of evils follow. Presumably, he didn't really mean to suggest that widowhood could follow directly from my Darwinism, but his letter, by this point, had reached that level of frenzied malevolence which I repeatedly recognise among my Christian correspondents. I have devoted a whole book, Unweaving the Rainbow, to ultimate meaning, to the poetry of science, and to rebutting, specifically and at length, the charge of nihilistic negativity, so I shall restrain myself here. This chapter is about evil and its opposite, good, about morality, where it comes from, why we should embrace it, and whether we need religion to do so. Does our moral sense have a Darwinian origin? On the face of it, the Darwinian idea that evolution is driven by natural selection seems ill-suited to explain such goodness as we possess, or our feelings of morality, decency, empathy, and pity. Natural selection can easily explain hunger, fear, and sexual lust, all of which straightforwardly contribute to our survival or the preservation of our genes. But what about the wrenching compassion we feel when we see an orphan child weeping, an old widow in despair from loneliness, or an animal whimpering in pain? What gives us the powerful urge to send an anonymous gift of money or clothes to tsunami victims on the other side of the world whom we shall never meet, and who are highly unlikely to return the favour? Where does the Good Samaritan in us come from?
There are four good Darwinian reasons for individuals to be altruistic, generous, or moral towards each other. First, there is the special case of genetic kinship. Second, there is reciprocation, the repayment of favours given and the giving of favours in anticipation of payback. Following on from this, there is third, the Darwinian benefit of acquiring a reputation for generosity and kindness. And fourth, if the Israeli zoologist Amot Zahavi is right, there is the particular additional benefit of conspicuous generosity as a way of buying unfakeably authentic advertising. Through most of our prehistory, humans lived under conditions that would have strongly favoured the evolution of all four kinds of altruism. We lived in villages, or earlier in discrete roving bands like baboons, partially isolated from neighbouring bands or villages. Most of your fellow band members would have been kin, more closely related to you than members of other bands. Plenty of opportunities for kin altruism to evolve. And whether kin or not, you would tend to meet the same individuals again and again throughout your life. Ideal conditions for the evolution of reciprocal altruism. Those are also the ideal conditions for building a reputation for altruism, and the very same ideal conditions for advertising conspicuous generosity. By any or all of the four routes, genetic tendencies towards altruism would have been favoured in early humans. It is easy to see why our prehistoric ancestors would have been good to their own in-group, but bad, to the point of xenophobia, towards other groups. But why, now that most of us live in big cities where we are no longer surrounded by kin, and where every day we meet individuals whom we are never going to meet again, why are we still so good to each other, even sometimes to others who might be thought to belong to an out-group?
It is important not to misstate the reach of natural selection. Selection does not favour the evolution of a cognitive awareness of what is good for your genes. That awareness had to wait for the 20th century to reach a cognitive level, and even now full understanding is confined to a minority of scientific specialists. What natural selection favours is rules of thumb, which work in practice to promote the genes that built them. Rules of thumb, by their nature, sometimes misfire. In a bird's brain, the rule, look after small squawking things in your nest and drop food into their red gapes, typically has the effect of preserving the genes that built the rule, because the squawking, gaping objects in an adult bird's nest are normally its own offspring. The rule misfires if another baby bird somehow gets into the nest, a circumstance that is positively engineered by cuckoos. Could it be that our Good Samaritan urges are misfirings, analogous to the misfiring of a reed warbler's parental instincts when it works itself to the bone for a young cuckoo? The mistake, or byproduct idea, which I'm espousing, works like this. Natural selection in ancestral times when we lived in small and stable bands like baboons programmed into our brains altruistic urges alongside sexual urges, hunger urges, xenophobic urges, and so on. An intelligent couple can read their Darwin and know that the ultimate reason for their sexual urges is procreation. They know that the woman cannot conceive because she is on the pill. Yet they find that their sexual desire is in no way diminished by the knowledge. Sexual desire is sexual desire, and its force, in an individual's psychology, is independent of the ultimate Darwinian pressure that drove it. It is a strong urge which exists independently of its ultimate rationale. I am suggesting that the same is true of the urge to kindness, to altruism, to generosity, to empathy, to pity. In ancestral times, we had the opportunity to be altruistic only towards close kin and potential reciprocators. Nowadays, that restriction is no longer there, but the rule of thumb persists. Why would it not? It is just like sexual desire. We can no more help ourselves feeling pity when we see a weeping unfortunate, who is unrelated and unable to reciprocate, than we can help ourselves feeling lust for a member of the opposite sex, who may be infertile or otherwise unable to reproduce. Both are misfirings, Darwinian mistakes, blessed, precious mistakes. Do not for one moment think of such Darwinizing as demeaning or reductive of the noble emotions of compassion and generosity, nor of sexual desire. Sexual desire, when channeled through the conduits of linguistic culture, emerges as great poetry and drama, John Donne's love poems say, or Romeo and Juliet. And of course, the same thing happens with the misfired redirection of kin and reciprocation-based compassion. Mercy to a debtor is, when seen out of context, as un-Darwinian as adopting someone else's child.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath.
Sexual lust is the driving force behind a large proportion of human ambition and struggle, and much of it constitutes a misfiring. There is no reason why the same should not be true of the lust to be generous and compassionate, if this is the misfired consequence of ancestral village life. The best way for natural selection to build in both kinds of lust in ancestral times was to install rules of thumb in the brain. Those rules still influence us today, even where circumstances make them inappropriate to their original functions. Such rules of thumb influence us still, not in a Calvinistically deterministic way, but filter through the civilizing influences of literature and custom, law and tradition, and of course religion. Just as the primitive brain rule of sexual lust passes through the filter of civilization to emerge in the love scenes of Romeo and Juliet, so primitive brain rules of us versus them vendetta emerge in the form of the running battles between Capulets and Montagues, while primitive brain rules of altruism and empathy end up in the misfiring that cheers us in the chastened reconciliation of Shakespeare's final scene. If there is no God, why be good? Posed like that, the question sounds positively ignoble. When a religious person puts it to me in this way, and many of them do, my immediate temptation is to issue the following challenge. Do you really mean to tell me the only reason you try to be good is to gain God's approval and reward, or to avoid his disapproval and punishment? That's not morality. That's just sucking up, apple polishing, looking over your shoulder at the great surveillance camera in the sky, or the still small wiretap inside your head, monitoring your every move, even your every base thought. As Einstein said,
if people are good only because they fear punishment and hope for reward, then we are a sorry lot indeed.
Michael Shermer, in The Science of Good and Evil, calls it a debate stopper. If you agree that, in the absence of God, you would commit robbery, rape, and murder, you reveal yourself as an immoral person, and we would be well advised to steer a wide course around you. If, on the other hand, you admit that you would continue to be a good person even when not under divine surveillance, you have fatally undermined your claim that God is necessary for us to be good. I suspect that quite a lot of religious people do think religion is what motivates them to be good, especially if they belong to one of those faiths that systematically exploits personal guilt. It seems to me to require quite a low self-regard to think that, should belief in God suddenly vanish from the world, we would all become callous and selfish hedonists with no kindness, no charity, no generosity, nothing that would deserve the name of goodness. Most thoughtful people would agree that morality in the absence of policing is somehow more truly moral than the kind of false morality that vanishes as soon as the police go on strike or the spy camera is switched off, whether the spy camera is a real one monitored in the police station or an imaginary one in heaven.
Moral philosophers are the professionals when it comes to thinking about right and wrong. They classify themselves in many ways, but for our purposes it will be enough to distinguish absolutists from consequentialists. Absolutists believe there are absolutes of right and wrong, imperatives whose rightness makes no reference to their consequences. Consequentialists more pragmatically hold that the morality of an action should be judged by its consequences. One version of consequentialism is utilitarianism, the philosophy associated with Jeremy Bentham and others. Utilitarianism is often summed up in Bentham's unfortunately imprecise catchphrase, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation."
The springboard for this discussion of moral philosophy was a hypothetical religious claim that, without a God, morals are relative and arbitrary. The preferred source of absolute morality is usually a holy book of some kind, interpreted as having an authority far beyond its history's capacity to justify. Indeed, adherents of scriptural authority show distressingly little curiosity about the normally highly dubious historical origins of their holy books. The next chapter will demonstrate that, in any case, people who claim to derive their morals from Scripture do not really do so in practice. And a very good thing, too, as they themselves, on reflection, should agree.